This is the second day of this December 2016 four-day session. I'm going to continue reading from this book, Faith in Mind, a commentary on Sung San's classic by Chan Master Sheng Yen. And we're going to start here with a section that's entitled Stilling Words and Thoughts, and he begins with a verse from the from Faith in Mind. Before I read his version of this, let me read you ours. We chant, the more you talk and think on this, the further from the truth you'll be. Cut off all useless thoughts and words, and there's nowhere you cannot go. So in his version, it's excessive talking and thinking turn you from harmony with the way. Cut off talking and thinking, and there is nowhere you cannot penetrate. Pretty much the same thing. And he begins, people like to talk, especially if they feel lonely. Those who tend to talk nonstop generally have difficulty with practice and also make it difficult for others to practice. In our Chan retreat, talking is forbidden. Of course, that's one of the three big rules for our sessions as well. No talking, no looking around, not checking other people out. Keep the eyes down. And then the third is just recommended that you not eat as much as you normally do. Eat less. Roshi is fond of saying that just these three things will take you quite a ways. Really, Sesshin, we're really cutting off a lot of the things that stir up the mind. And that has an effect. You can't go through a sesshin and not be changed. Even if you feel your practice isn't taking hold, you're lost in thoughts, spinning your wheels, nevertheless, change is happening just from this fast, this cutting back on the amount of distractions that we are forced to deal with. It's almost a luxury to have so little input. But it's difficult if you love to talk or you love to think. It says, in our Chan retreat, talking is forbidden, but there are still some people who cannot resist covertly saying a few words. Others honor the rule and refrain from speaking, but that does not mean that they are not talking to themselves. Ouch. All day long, while they are sitting, they come up with a theme and then carry on a conversation with themselves. They ponder over all sorts of issues. As an example, once a certain writer attended a retreat. During the first day, he came up with the idea for a novel. While sitting, he sketched out the plot and the various characters. In the private interview the next day, I asked him how he'd been doing, and he said, I've been making plans for my new novel. I said to him, perhaps you should go home and start writing your novel now. Otherwise, by the end of the retreat, you will have forgotten all the great ideas you have come up with. Think of people who come out of sesshin, sometimes out of the Rohatsu sesshin, the January sesshin, that's just a month or two before Sangha Entertainment Night, and they've written a skit. I know Roshi finds that very painful. It says, if you talk too much, either with your mouth or in your head, it will be difficult to make progress. It's just the way it is. When you find it hard to concentrate, it is very easy to start talking to yourself. You may not even be able to control it. I have some experience with this. And one of the things that's interesting when you pay attention to what's going on is that we all have our favorite topics. There are some thoughts are easy to cut off. We notice them and come right back to the practice, to the method. But others are stickier. They just seem, somehow we give them a pass, and we find ourselves, whether it's a Sangha entertainment skit or remembering the plot of a movie or just any number of things. And of course, if it's something that's involved with our security or our love life or our practice, something involved with our practice, somehow that seems important enough to give it a pass. Go ahead and think a few more thoughts, follow that train down a little ways. It helps to have the intention to make the effort to cut thoughts off right when they arise. Often said, it's like a thought is like you're smoking a cigarette, if anybody still does that these days. You're smoking a cigarette and you're wearing a wool sweater, let's say, and the ash of the cigarette falls on the sweater. If you knock that ash off immediately, no damage done, but if you let it linger, you're going to burn a hole. When you notice thoughts, if you drop them right away, no damage done. But once you start to indulge them even a little bit, they tend to stick around. It's difficult. It can feel lonely. It can feel doesn't always feel good to let those things go. There's a movie I saw a long time ago called A Beautiful Mind. It's about the physicist John Nash, a brilliant man who also was, I believe, schizophrenic. At any rate, he hallucinated. He saw imaginary people who were not there, had conversations with them. And in the movie, there's a point at which he comes to terms with this. And he kneels down, I believe he kneels down to one little girl who's one of the cast of characters who are there with him all the time, and says, "I can't speak with you anymore." And for the rest of the movie, they're still there, but they're standing on the perimeter, and they're no longer part of his thoughts, no longer part of his actions. We can't control what thoughts come up. We don't have the ability to say, okay, I'm not going to think about that anymore. That's definitely someplace I don't want to go. Because they come without our consciously willing them. They appear in the mind. You could say, in a sense, we have control over them because the ones that come are the ones that we've entertained. You spread out the welcome mat, you can be sure that thought will be back. A lot of times the impulse to talk or to think comes from a fear of silence, and being uncomfortable with silence. It's one of the other great virtues of Sesshin is that we are immersed in silence, and willy-nilly we tend to become used to it. Of course, if we fill it up with thoughts and playing with our mind, not so much, but still, to be comfortable with silence, to be able to sit alone in a room without fidgeting, without looking for some sort of distraction. Our culture seems like it's just based on distraction. It's what the media is all about. The internet is full of clickbait. This one weird trick that your doctor will hate. Can end up going down a lot of fruitless paths, surfing the web. And you hear from so many people how addictive their smartphones are. You have to look for that in ourselves, how often we just reflexively are reaching for it to do something, quote, important, end quote. It's one of the reasons why in Sesshin we invite people to park their phones with the monitors. You definitely, definitely don't want to be on your phone in Sesshin. There's a routine that the comedian Louis C.K. Does about our tendency to continually dip into texting or using our smartphones. And in his telling of it, it starts with a little feeling of sadness or anxiety or something, anything that makes us uncomfortable. And then immediately we want to do something, get our minds off of it. And yet, if we can take that in, if we can see something happens to balance that out. Something gets processed. Something gets understood. You don't want to, certainly if you're a Zen practitioner, you don't want to live your life running away from what you're afraid of or what's somewhat unpleasant. Don't want to go looking for pain, but we don't want to flinch either. We don't want to run away. And that's what talking and thinking does. It takes us away. Says there's a deeper interpretation of these lines. That is, you should not try to use logic or theory to answer certain questions in your practice. Some examples are, why have I come here for a retreat? What is the purpose of practice? What is enlightenment? If you get involved in this kind of questioning to justify your practice, then you simply cannot practice. Again, these are thoughts that somehow seem like they need to be answered, but we need to just set them aside. He said, after a few days of practice, many people completely stop thinking about themselves and their outside affairs. However, they keep dwelling on my words. Whatever I say is meant to guide your practice, but when you are actually practicing, you should just use the method and not think about what I have said. The less you talk to yourself, the closer you will be to the highest way. This is advice that Roshi gives people at workshops. Don't worry about remembering what's said. It goes in. It goes into the subconscious. Certainly don't want to take notes. He says, I once told a student, you really have to practice very hard to overcome ignorance. For two sitting periods, she was constantly thinking, how am I ignorant? Unable to contain it any longer, she got up and said to me, I can eat, I can sleep, so I am really not ignorant. I said, look at a dog, a cat, a mosquito. They can eat and rest. Are you saying that they don't have any ignorance? Then she said, tell me what to do so that I won't be ignorant. I said, try to meditate and recite the Buddha's name. This is interesting. In Chan, as opposed to Japanese Zen, you have side by side in the same temple or monastery people doing what we think of as Zen practice and others doing Pure Land practice, where the practice is reciting the name of the Buddha Amitabha. In Japanese, the formulation is Namu Amida Butsu, which means I place my faith or I take refuge in the Buddha Amida. It is a valid practice. It's not Zen. But in China, they sort of live comfortably side by side. There is even a koan, which people may be given, which is who is reciting the name of Amida. Anyway, he assigned her to recite the Buddha's name. She went back to her cushion and meditated on the Buddha's name. But again, she thought to herself, since I am here meditating and reciting the Buddha's name, I am not ignorant. After another two periods, she came to me again and said, in fact, I don't have any problems. I have been sitting here feeling very comfortable. It is you who have vexations. I don't know where he... I think one of the reasons... There's throughout this book, there's a number of feisty students with strange who come at Shengyan from strange places. And I think one of the reasons is a lot of his students are actually Chinese and are coming out of a different culture than ours. I can't imagine an American coming at the teacher in quite this way. We have our other ways. He says her problem was that although she took my words seriously, she would turn them over and over in her mind instead of actually applying the method during practice. Practice is so simple, and yet somehow we can avoid doing it for so long. Spend our whole time reading the menu instead of eating the meal. It is only when you no longer have any words or thoughts that the perfect way will manifest before you, and, quote, there is nowhere you cannot penetrate, end quote. The meaning is not that you can go anywhere, but that there is no need to go anywhere, because in the state of no words and no thoughts, you are in the midst of anywhere and every place. How do you get to the state of no words and no thoughts? By picking up the method and putting down your attachment to other things. By being vigilant. By recognizing what's going on. Seeing our thoughts. So easy for thoughts to get started and we simply don't know it. It's a metaphor I love. Roshi used once in a sesshin, compared practice to driving down a limited access highway. So, you know, we know what to do, point the car in the right direction, and we're driving, but we keep turning off on an exit ramp. And when we do, all we have to do is just get back on. Sometimes we turn off on an exit ramp and instead of immediately getting back on, we turn off on a side road and wind down through town, and next thing you know, we're in a trailer by the river. Of course, the difference is when we want to come back, boom, we can come right back. We don't have to wind our way through. We don't have to go back through our train of petty, ridiculous thoughts and find out where it all began. Just go back to the practice. He quotes another stanza from the poem, "Return to the root and attain the principle. Pursue illumination and you lose it. One moment of reversing the light is greater than the previous emptiness." reading this, it's hard to know what part of the verses on the faith mind this is in our version, so I copied it out. What we say is, returning to the root itself, you'll find the meaning of all things. If you pursue appearances, you overlook the primal source. Awakening is to go beyond both emptiness as well as form. He says, in practice, you may try to penetrate to the emptiness of phenomena, but as long as illumination is directed toward outward appearances, you miss the primal source. It is only by turning the illumination inward that you return to the source and get to the meaning of all things. And you can do this, if you can do this, even for a split second, you will transcend the state of emptiness. This is looking into the mind, sometimes called the backward step. Looking into the source of our thoughts. How do you return to the root? By letting go of all words and thoughts and eliminating all grasping and rejection. You must begin with a method, but at some point you must let it go. I think that's a little, that can be misunderstood. If you get into a state of complete absorption, the method may disappear, but you don't need to worry about making a decision to let the method go. Really, very few decisions that you have to make other than coming back to the practice. It's like the story of a marine biologist. Someone went out with a marine biologist on a boat out in shark-infested waters, and maybe it was a reporter or something, and they were going to go into the water. They had their scuba gear on, and they're all set, and they said to the marine biologist, now if I encounter a shark, what should I do? And the answer was, oh, don't worry, the shark will make all the decisions. You should not hold on to any experiences that may come up. When the method and experiences are no longer necessary to you, you will have returned to the source. This source, or Buddha nature, is the lively manifestation of great liberation and great wisdom. In great liberation, there is nothing left. Practitioners often go from being attached to existence to being attached to emptiness. If one thinks that emptiness is true wisdom or liberation, under this delusion one cannot attain the ultimate. It is natural for people to become attached to their experiences. One student who sat very well last night tried to repeat the experience today by recalling exactly what he did that resulted in that great sitting. Who hasn't done this? But today the sitting went very poorly. This was due to his greed for the experience. It's difficult to do, to throw away, to let go of our positive experiences. It's very easy to get tripped up. And nevertheless, to get into a state of emptiness, get into some sort of a samadhi state, can be extremely heartening, can often be a big turning point in people's practice, increasing their faith. But if you let greed get into it, and if you let if you start being in charge of results, then you're going to be miles away from getting there again. Really have to abandon hope. Abandon our demands. He says we should not seek Buddha nature or enlightenment. Rather, we should let it come about naturally. such questions as when will I get enlightened or is there a Buddha nature will take you even farther away from Buddha nature, which is a totality and not something you can grasp. Buddha nature is in the totality of your own self. Why should it or why would it be necessary to try to attain it? And how can you get hold of it? Don't practice with the thought of reaching Buddhahood. Just put forth your best efforts. The next section is called Giving Up Expectations, and he begins with this verse: do not abide in dualistic views. Take care not to seek after them. As soon as there is right and wrong, the mind is scattered and lost. Or as we chant it, if there is a trace of right and wrong, true mind is lost, confused, distraught. It says, dualistic views refer to the discriminating mind. They include any doubts about the correctness of your method or whether your decision to attend this retreat was a right or a wrong one. If you lack faith, you will doubt the method you are using. On the other hand, if your confidence is too strong, then you will be expecting something out of the practice. Neither extreme is beneficial. To come to a retreat merely out of curiosity shows a lack of faith in yourself and in the practice, and it would be impossible for you to get good results. From the very beginning, you're denying yourself the possibility of doing well on retreat. At the same time, you may harbor certain resentments. You may get annoyed at the people around you or even at your own body when your legs cause you pain. You may be critical of the food or the style of the retreat. All those kinds of noise. On the other hand, he says, having too much faith in yourself is likewise a problem. Someone who was extremely confident came to one retreat. He was highly intelligent and a top student. He thought, if a person like me cannot get enlightened, then who can? Don't see too many like this, at least not openly. After one day of practice, his back ached, his legs hurt, and he began to question if this was the way to get enlightened. One evening in the Chan Hall, he heard me say, if you can do it, sit through the night. He concluded that in order to get enlightened, he should forego sleep. By midnight, his eyes were heavy, but he forced himself to continue sitting. After 3 days of this, he was totally exhausted, and he said to me, now I have some idea of this enlightenment you are talking about. Basically, you just have to go without sleep. Yeah, if it were only that easy. There is value to pushing our boundaries. Of course, in the evenings, after the final sitting is over, people do yaza, late night sitting, that's a Japanese word for it, and this can really be helpful. It's difficult at first. I remember doing yaza, and just every time I tried, it seemed like I just couldn't get anywhere. It was more difficult for me to sit outside of the formal sittings than it was during, because I was basically being led around by the fact that I could stop. It's much easier to sit when you can't. It's the way that we all help each other by upholding the form of sesshin. But there is a real virtue in developing the ability to sit on our own. And there are some qualities to late night sitting that we don't see during the regular rounds when the stick is being used and there's more movement and more people. Something you have to experiment with. And one of the things that keeps people from sitting more at night is just their fear of getting exhausted. And that's not a totally unjustified concern. You can sit up so much that you're just completely wrecked, and that can be very difficult to go through. You will recover. But a lot of times we stop way before our limit. It's useful to find out what you can do. It's useful to push past what you think your limits are. In fact, to really get into the spirit of Sesshin, you need to be testing yourself a little bit. Remember when I was learning to ski, somebody told me, if you don't fall every day, you're not pushing yourself enough. The opposite, of course, is what this guy did, maybe pushing himself a bit too hard. And sometimes lots of extra sitting can be a substitute for being totally committed to the practice, for dropping thoughts, for letting the mind be still, for turning the mind backwards and looking into the practice. Shingyan says, practice is like cooking rice. If you use a gentle flame, the rice will be perfect and easy to digest, whereas with a high flame, it will burn before it is done. One should practice with a very relaxed attitude. Again, this Chinese approach. Need to learn to be relaxed without thoughts, without giving in to distraction. Need to learn the difference between using the mind and trying to do it with the body. Our habits that we've built up over an entire lifetime aren't going to leave us just because we've come here to Sesshin. It's not unusual to find ourselves tensing up. Maybe the shoulders come up a little bit as you try to concentrate. End up with pains here and there. But over time, we work through it. Looking to let the mind sink into the practice. If we're working on the breath, to let the breath fill our awareness. It doesn't require any kind of physical tension. We need to learn how to do it, and we learn how to do it by going at it and going at it, and by not getting in our own way by demanding that we get certain results, by having faith in the method, as Shengyan says. So saying in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, don't quit before the miracle. He says, if you do not abide in duality, neither having too much nor too little confidence, then what should you do? You have not come here to get enlightened, but to practice. It is not important whether you have a good grasp of the matter and can enter the practice deeply or not. Just do not have any doubts about the method or whether you have the right stuff to practice. Do not underestimate yourself. If others can practice, then at least you can try. There's a passage in a book by John Blofeld. He was one of the early translators of old Chan texts. And he wrote a book about the Bodhisattva of Compassion. And there's a section there where he's talking about himself. And he had various Chinese friends that were sort of mentoring him. And he was really intrigued by the difference between self-power and other power. So this is kind of a brief shorthand way of distinguishing between Zen practice and the Pure Land practice, reciting the Buddha's name. In Zen, we rely on our own power, or at least that's the way it's put, and in Pure Land, we're relying on the power of Amitabha Buddha. Or that's the way it's put. So he was making this distinction and sort of comparing himself favorably to superstitious peasants who just worship Buddha and have no understanding of Zen. And one of his friends upbraided him and said, this journey that we're on is a journey of 10,000 miles. So you understand something about self-power and other power, and maybe this puts you a step ahead of someone else. How much difference does that make on a journey like this? And if you're a step behind, if you know your practice you feel doesn't, if you've indulged yourself in comparing yourself with others and you feel, oh, I'm just not up to this, it's not the case. We're all going on a long journey. This is not even a matter for just one lifetime. Important thing is just to move, to take a step, to go forward. Once a student who did well on her first retreat came a second time. At first, everything went fine, but then a problem arose. While sitting, it occurred to her that counting the breath was really boring. If she spent her time reciting the name of Buddha, she thought, then at least she would be accumulating merit. But what was the use of counting from 1 to 10? Towards evening, she said to me, Shifu, that's the Chan version of Roshi, I guess is the simplest way to put it. Shifu, I don't want to stay on this retreat. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Even a kid in kindergarten can do that. Why should I waste my time here? When your mind strays from the method, problems will appear. In fact, the method is inherently meaningless. It is irrelevant to discuss whether it brings merit or not. The purpose of a method is to train your mind. You could raise the same objection about prostrating to the Buddha or morning and evening chanting. Why should practice take these forms? People often wonder, if Chan is a method of sudden enlightenment which does not depend on meditation, then why do we practice meditation and go on 7-day retreats? If someone objects that these things are unrelated to Chan, I say that if you want to study Chan, I will instruct you in exactly these methods. In order to practice, you must believe in your teacher and in his methods. If you search for methods on your own, you may not find anything and eventually give up practicing. Or you may find something weird and end up in a demonic state with mental and physical problems. Can definitely get in trouble practicing on our own. You can do it. When Roshi Kaplow wrote The Three Pillars of Zen, he wrote it as an instruction manual for people who wouldn't have access to a teacher, because at the time it seemed unlikely that Zen would sweep across America. But it's so important to have some kind of feedback, to have somebody who's not trapped like you inside your own thoughts, somebody who can look objectively from the outside, and someone who has some experience with what you're dealing with can be very helpful. We've always told people who can't come here not to assign themselves a koan. It's probably a really bad idea. Of course, there are cases in, you know, the history of Zen where someone has had some sort of spontaneous question that came up that gave them no peace and eventually brought them to awakening. But to pick up a koan like what is mu or whatever because you've read about it and then to try to work on it is not a great idea. It may be ineffective, or if it is effective, it may open up things that you're not ready to deal with. And you don't have a teacher there with you. So as Sheng Yin says, you may find something weird and end up in a demonic state with mental and physical problems. Meditation should just be a part of life. If you have other motivations, it will lead to problems. When you approach the practice without any expectations, without any expectations, you will not be able to sit well. Not only should you not have any When you approach the practice with any expectations, you will not be able to sit well. Not only should you not have any expectations of getting enlightened or becoming a Chan master, but you should not even expect to be free from your pain. Do not hope that your legs or back will stop hurting. Do not try to overcome the pain as if you had burst through a barrier. Simply accept the pain. So this can be a subtle point, but it's a really big one. Dealing with pain, the lesson that we learn from pain and sesshin is an extremely valuable one. And I know people who've struggled with pain for many sesshins, and then it disappeared and they missed it. A lot of times it's a real goad to practice. Keeps us on track. But we need to know how to deal with it and to try to conquer it. He says to overcome it as if you had burst through a barrier just isn't an effective strategy. Simply accept the pain. So much of our suffering, physical suffering, comes from our unwillingness just to be with things as they are. And so much of the value of pain is learning to be with things as they are. It says, you may not feel very happy about it, but at least do not resent it. If you cannot accept it, then ignore it and turn your mind to the method. When the pain becomes too great to ignore, place your attention on the pain itself. This is a method that Roshi Kaplow had me do. I really struggled with pain in my early sesshins. Actually would change the mudra that I used, the hand mudra, rather than having the thumbs touching lightly, making this sort of oval. You can grasp the thumb of the left hand with the right hand, sort of make a fist there, and just lock in. And then put your mind right in the knee or whatever it is that's hurting. And if you really concentrate it on completely, the pain can disappear or diminish. But the best is to be able just to accept it, just to be with it. This is what dogs and cats do. This is what animals do. They don't have the thoughts that we have. Is how long is this going to last and is it going to get worse? All those anxious thoughts. When I was struggling with pain back in those sesshins, I had a pattern that I noticed. I would sit fine for the first 15 minutes of the round or so, and then all of a sudden I wonder if that pain is going to come. And right when I thought that, it would. It was amazing. It would just flare up. Evidently, when I had that thought, something tensed up, and lo and behold, there I was, struggling through the last half of the round. Just don't think that way anymore. I think one of the... I'd been gone from the center for a number of years, and... things suddenly aligned in my life and changed for the better. And one of the things I wanted to do was come back, and I did, and went back into sesshin. And, of course, my legs had not cured themselves in the interim. And at one point in Doksan, I was asking Roshi about it, and he said, John, just trust the process. And for some reason, that just resonated. That just, okay. And I think that was the point at which things started to get better for me. This whole practice is something beyond our control. It's been going on for thousands of years. People just like us have encountered problems just like ours, and we can do it too. Having faith in this process. Such an important asset. It's not overconfidence. We don't know what's going to happen. It's not based on comparing ourselves with anybody else. It's just this feeling, this sense somewhere that this is path. This path is a good path. This is where I need to go. Little changes in our attitude towards our practice, towards Sesshin, can make a tremendous difference. Sometimes they're a long time coming, but they will come. It wasn't long after that Sesshin where Roshi told me to trust the process, I made my way finally to a 7-day Sesshin. And all the struggles were there, of course. But on the morning of the 5th day, I think during the work period, I all of a sudden realized, I'm glad I'm here. I was struck. I'm glad I'm here. Got to be pretty stubborn to go to Sesshin after Sesshin when you're not glad you're there, but somehow or other, I did that. And I have to say, I'm glad I'm here. Okay, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the 4 vows.